Romans chapter 1, verse 16. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that, when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Wherefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie, and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. The Lord will add his own blessing to the reading of his own precious word for his name's sake. I'm getting a sign, I think, that says my microphone isn't on. Is that right? It's showing on here, and so if it... The battery must be... I would say it's an apostate battery. Actually, I think Dale told me this morning this battery was so good it had done 16 hours or something without replacement. I think we have just tried it beyond its endurance. Anyway, we'll not go into the truthfulness of battery signs when it says on and it's off. However, we'll take it as it comes. The Lord will bless this great passage in Romans chapter 1. I always like to read Romans 1 no matter what I'm preaching on. If I'm ever stuck to what to read, I always want to turn back to Romans 1. The only trouble is I have a propensity to forget what I was going to preach on anyway and just preach in Romans 1. So I better be careful I don't do that tonight. I think of all the chapters I like to read and deal with, Romans 1 ranks very high to be followed only by the chapters that follow it in the book of Romans. But we come tonight in our millennial milestones to think of the 19th century. As no doubt people like Mr. Farr and Dr. Barrett will remember, the 19th century was dynamic, bustling, and constantly changing. When you read of it, you discover it was a time of upheaval in just about every Western nation. Upheaval in society, upheaval in politics, and very certainly upheaval in religion. It was a century that produced great movements in just about every arena of human endeavor. It started off by naturally carrying on the theme that we noted in the 18th century, which was one of revival and revolution. And as you continue into the 19th century, you find there were revivals, and there were certainly plenty of revolutions. The 19th century was the century that saw the development of the industrialized world. It saw the abolition of black slavery, and it saw the institution of virtual white slavery in the industrialized countries as more and more workers migrated from the country to the cities to be swallowed up in the great black holes of industrial exploitation. It was a century that reshaped the continent of Europe. Late in the 1700s, France, of course, had her great revolution, the 1789 revolution, that brought Napoleon Bonaparte to power in 1795. Bonaparte constantly strengthened his power base. He became the self-crowned emperor, the conqueror of Europe. He led France into 20 years of ceaseless wars with Germany, Austria, Spain, Russia, and England. In 1848, long after Bonaparte had departed this world, after the monarchy of Louis-Philippe had been reinstated, France was again racked by revolution, this time to throw out the monarchs forever. Not only France, but on this occasion also Germany and significantly Italy. In this century, the Pope lost his temporal and political kingdom. And that is a story all of its own, how the Italian nation struggled finally to have some say in the political running of what were known as the Papal States. But as he lost his temporal power, the Pope added significantly to his spiritual power. In 1854, he decreed that the Virgin Mary had been conceived without sin, the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary, making that a doctrine to be received on peril of losing your soul. And then in 1870, having a loaded Vatican Council, my memory's right, with over 270 Italian bishops in attendance, when the total of other European bishops came to about 256, with that loaded inbuilt majority, he had the Vatican Council decree that he was infallible when speaking ex cathedra, that is, speaking as the chief shepherd of the church on matters of faith and morals. It was a century to reshape Europe. It was a century also that reshaped America. The 1800s were a century of great geographical and political expansion here in the United States, as America pursued what many saw to be her manifest destiny. There was the development of that laissez-faire individualism that has become the hallmark of this great nation. Throughout the century, there were multiple cases of crusades on moral issues. We tend to think of those as the invention of Jerry Falwell and the moral majority, but there were great moral crusades long before. There were also many powerful and genuine spiritual awakenings. And out of those awakenings there grew the uniquely American form of revivalism. There is a vast difference between revival and revivalism. I would commend to your attention a book by Ian Murray with that title, Revival and Revivalism. But out of the revivals in America, there came this American revivalism. And of course, the 19th century was the century of America's cataclysmic civil war. It was a century to reshape this nation. In many ways, you could say it was a century that reshaped the world for good and for evil. There were two forces at work as the century developed, and I will want to highlight those particularly tonight. The first was evangelicalism. The second was evolutionism. Evangelicalism crusaded across the world, drawing men out of darkness unto Christ and setting them on their upward way to glory. Evolutionism burst upon the world and gave rebels against God a pseudo-scientific argument, the very thing that they had been looking for, to lay hold of the popular mind, to undermine faith in God and in His Word, to turn men from truth as revealed to what they said was truth as proved by scientific investigation and experimentation. These then were the two great forces that ultimately were to shape the century and all that followed. In the 19th century, as I said, there were many widespread, powerful revivals. This was a high time for biblical, evangelical preaching and experience. Here in America, the century started with the second Great Awakening already in operation. Started very late in the 1790s and continued for many years. In fact, historians have not quite agreed as to how long the second Great Awakening continued. I have personally come to the conclusion that you could say that it continued for some 30, maybe 35 years. I have read one reputable historian who says that it continued for 7 decades. And if that's so, or anywhere nearly so, it would make it the longest running revival that this or any other modern country has known. The Second Great Awakening was, in many ways, a mixed movement. It was a movement in which Presbyterians, Methodists, and Baptists were all involved in the preaching of the gospel. They all had their different emphases and different outlooks, but they combined greatly. They showed an admirable spirit of Christian unity and tolerance as they stood together on the great fundamentals of the faith, preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, breaking new ground, and especially expanding westward as the country went westward, bringing the gospel to the frontiers of the nation and bringing many into Christ. They had their differences. They had their little foibles. You would wonder sometimes where Christianity ended and comedy began. If you were to take those who were into shuddering and shaking, they would make the modern charismatics seem as if they were staid Puritans. There were, among the Methodists, many smitings down. I remember reading of the ministry of the great Methodist preacher Peter Cartwright, and some people fell down in his meetings and came under great conviction of sin and trembled, shook like a leaf in the breeze, and were in terrible turmoil of soul until they would come to faith in Christ. A young lady from a rather upper-class family came to his meetings, and she came under this great conviction. Her brothers were outside, and they were not at all pleased or amused, and so they decided they were going to horsewhip the preacher. And so they made it known. Cartwright was not a man and to tremble before any man, or to back down before any man. And so he came out to these young fellows who were ready to horsewhip him. And he asked them what this was all about. And they said, "Well, we saw you reach into your pocket." I don't know if it was a snuff box or whatever he had in his pocket. I think that's probably what it was, but he had this little box. And they said, "We saw you reach into your pocket and you pulled this out, and whatever was in that box, we know that you did something to our sister. We're going to whip you for it." He says, "Is that right, boys?" And he reached into his pocket and he pulled out the box. And he said, "Well, maybe I'll do it to you too." And they didn't wait to horsewhip him. They ran in case the genie would get out of the box. As I say, there are times hard to tell where Christianity ended and the comedy began. But there certainly was a mighty movement of the Spirit of God right across America. Dr. Sprague's lectures on revival that were published or republished some years ago by the Banner of Truth give you the outlook of solid men of God about revivals in that period. In the back of that book there are 20 letters from important religious leaders, most of them giving accounts of the revivals under their ministry. There were men like Timothy Dwight. Timothy Dwight, the grandson of Jonathan Edwards, president of Yale University, concerned about the spiritual darkness of the college people, began to pray and began to preach. And that college that was wholly given over to wickedness and to the denial of the triune God, Yale College, was the center of a mighty spiritual awakening. There were evangelists who traveled the country. You've heard me mention many times the labors of Asahel Nettleton, a man who year after year after year traveled around the small towns, the smaller towns, going especially to the hard places, to places where Christianity had apparently failed, where churches had to close down, where no one was interested, and he would go in preaching, and before he had finished, the whole town would have professed faith in Jesus Christ. Many a time I have noted that the converts of those revivals under Asahel Nettleton were such that 20, 25 years later, they may report two or three backslidings. Backslidings counted because they were not attending prayer meeting, though they were still in church. Mighty movements of the Spirit of God. Then, of course, there came the revivalist that everybody knows about, Charles Grandison Finney. Finney, a converted lawyer, became a Presbyterian, gave up his Presbyterianism. From a Reformed, Protestant, evangelical point of view, in many ways a man flirting with heresy, a man with strange notions, but he was the man who decided it was time to democratize the gospel, essentially to preach that neither has arisen, since God has done all that he can do, there has arisen the necessity for men to bring themselves into Christ. And he was the one who introduced the new measures that have now become so popular indeed that if one does not go along with them, he's hardly thought to be evangelical at all. And the new measures included the anxious bench, the strong, emotional, powerful appeals for people to, as we would say today, walk the aisle or whatever. This push for immediate apparent results. That's when revivalism took over from revival. And under Finney, There was a movement that was more of flesh than of God. Even the Billy Graham Association has noted that when they went to do a campaign up in New England, there had not been anything in that area since the days of Charles Finney. Some Bible historians, or should I say Bible-believing historians, believe that Finney pursued a scorched earth policy. I think that is generally true. But it is true that the only thing that has ever flourished wherever Finney had a so-called revival has been Unitarianism. The gospel of Christ has been practically non-existent, non-effective there ever since. In other revivals, I think it would be true to say there are times when emotionalism was exalted over the intellect, when the desire for visible signs overran biblical doctrine, and revivalism degenerated in a great way from its biblical standards. In 1850, prayer meeting revival, a revival that spread soon across the ocean to the old world, to Ireland, to Wales, ultimately to Scotland and to England. In later years you had the ministry of Moody and of Sankey, especially after their tour of the United Kingdom in 1873-75, and then a host of other evangelists followed in their train. This was a century of great movements spiritually in America. Evangelicalism was on the march. The Sunday school movement really took deep root. Thousands of unchurched children in the great cities of America were brought in under the sound of the gospel. In fact, Moody's ministry really got underway as a Sunday school ministry. That's where his great evangelistic vision and fire and fervor first came to prominence. And all across the nation, there was this march of evangelical fervor reaching out to America to bring many unto Christ. And God blessed it in a glorious way. In Europe, there were similar movements. In England, there were here and there through the nation great movements of the Holy Ghost. For example, a little place called Redruth in Cornwall in 1814, there was a sudden outpouring of the Holy Spirit. And for 9 consecutive days in that little town, there was a mighty, powerful spirit of conviction. A contemporary account says hundreds were crying for mercy at once. Some remained in great distress of soul for 1 hour, some for 2, some for 6, 12, 15 hours before the Lord spoke peace in their souls. Then they would rise, extend their arms, and proclaim the wonderful works of God with such energy that standers-by would be struck in a moment and fall to the ground and roar for the disquietude of their own souls. This was not something that was manufactured by a preacher, greened up by a committee, but when God's servant started to preach, suddenly the Holy Ghost came down, took over the whole movement, began to do great things. Throughout the continent of Europe, there were evidences of great movements. In Geneva, a Scotsman by the name of Robert Haldane, famous to theological students for his commentary on the Epistle to the Romans, along with Hodge's commentary, I think the best one-volume commentary you're going to get on Romans. Robert Haldane went to the city of John Calvin in Geneva, gathered round him some young people, Those were days of great spiritual darkness and depression in Calvin City. The church was cold. The gospel was practically unknown. But as the great Scotch expositor, a layman, began to open up the epistle to the Romans, God began to move. And young theological students were moved by the Spirit of God and were swept into the kingdom. One of those who was saved at that time, by the way, was the great historian J.H. Merrill Daubigny, to whom we are indebted for the best of all histories of the Reformation. Man who later preached in Spurgeon's Tabernacle with great effectiveness and great acceptance. But there in Geneva, there was this, as they called it, the awakening. There was this movement of God. In Denmark, there was a pietistic type of revival, a great revulsion against the liberalism and the rationalism that were invading the church. In Sweden, an English preacher by the name of George Scott was a visiting preacher. He was there to mission among the Swedish people, and God visited Sweden with revival through the ministry of Scott. In Norway, a local preacher, Hans Nielsen Hauge, preached with power, and God blessed him, and God brought revival. Here, throughout Europe, these marks of the movings of the Spirit of God. There were movements like the Pietistic movement on the march in Germany, in Britain, and then in Europe, and later into America. There was the Brethren movement. Many of you will have heard of J.M. Darby. You may despise what Darby came to believe in his theology as he worked out a system that we know as dispensationalism, and he worked it out in a fairly extreme form that most modern dispensationalists really don't want to accept. But whatever you think of that, Darby was first a minister of the Anglican Church in Southern Ireland. And he was filled with a great evangelistic zeal. Down in County Wexford, he saw a movement of the Spirit of God. Every week, on average, 6 Roman Catholic families were coming to Christ. Now, when you think of the millions of a great city like New York or London or Atlanta or Los Angeles, 6 families doesn't sound a lot. But to this very day, there is no missionary in Southern Ireland seeing in such a restricted area 6 Roman Catholic families coming to Christ. This was a mighty work of God. And actually what drove Darby, started to drive Darby out of the Anglican Church and into the Brethren movement, was the decision of the Archbishop of Dublin, himself a famous man, Richard Trench, known for his work on the words of the Greek New Testament. But he demanded that all new converts coming into the church would swear allegiance to the English king. Let this be to every one of us a very serious warning. However strongly you hold your nationalistic and your political views, do not mix them up with the gospel of Jesus Christ. For what Richard Trench effectively did was to say, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and give up your views of Irish nationalism and believe in the English monarch and thou shalt be saved. And just like that, the whole work came to a close. Darby began to realize what was wrong with a system that so involved the church with the state. And so was born the Brethren movement. The Brethren movement in the early days had its difficulties, its divisions, its fights, and all the rest of it. But one has to look objectively and say they had great evangelists. They had men who preached at great personal discomfort. They went here and there with the gospel. They tramped the whole of the United Kingdom and then all over Europe, preaching Christ in all His simplicity. And God blessed them, and God used them, and there were many, many people turned to Christ. Then there was, of course, the great missionary movement. The 19th century was a time of revival, not only in the home field, but on the mission field. God did a work in that century through great preachers. In Scotland, they had Chalmers. They had another preacher, possibly a greater preacher than Chalmers, and Edward Irving. Edward Irving became the charismatic leader of his day. He lost his ministry and ruined the testimony that was bidding well and fair to shake the whole world for Christ. It's doubtful. This was pre-Spurgeon. It is doubtful if any preacher, even including the great Baptist, brought to the art of preaching a greater range of gifts and skills than Edward Irving, all burnt out on the charismatic altar of false fire. There were great preachers, not only in Scotland. England had its Spurgeon, but we tend to think that that's all there was. Spurgeon was one of a host of great preachers, though he was the greatest, in my opinion, of them all. America had its own host of preachers. I have mentioned Moody, who was never thought of as a great preacher, just a man who preached with great power. Give me my choice, and I would choose that any day over being a great preacher. There was the famous Dr. Talmage. I know that it is in vogue nowadays to despise the preaching of Talmage. It's so flowery. It's so insubstantial. I like to tell students, you can't live on a diet of Talmage, but I certainly recommend you to read him. And you will have insights, you will have thoughts, you will have flights of fancy that would never occur to an intellect like yours or mine. And certainly a man who moved thousands in his Brooklyn tabernacle as he preached the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. There were great philanthropists. The Brethren movement had Thomas Barnardo. That name is famous in Britain. The most famous orphanages in Britain to this day are Dr. Barnardo's homes. They also had the famous George Muller. Muller's work among the orphans. Spurgeon's work among the orphans. There were these great philanthropists. Lord Shaftesbury, one of England's leading parliamentarians, also one of her leading Christian philanthropists. And then there were the missionaries. Carey was still in the mission field. America sent Adoniram Judson. England sent Hudson Taylor. And later C.T. Studd. These were just in the vanguard of a mighty, mighty move of evangelical fervor to get the gospel to the ends of the earth. God blessed them, as I said, with revival. I have left to the end the thought of the great revival, the prayer meeting revival that struck America, spread across the world. And in this, to this very day, in my homeland, when you talk about 59, nobody has any doubt in the Christian church as to what you're speaking about. It's the 1859 revival. When after, 30 years of internecine warfare in the Presbyterian church, as it purged itself from Arianism, Unitarianism, as it paid the price for a pure witness for Jesus Christ, and then set itself the task of a faithful stand for God. After 30 years, God visited his church in giving revival. Four young men met to pray. In a little cold schoolhouse in the village of Kells in County Antrim. Through the long, dark, dreary winter, they met. They warmed themselves with the passion of their praying. Soon others joined them to pray. And soon God began to move. And from that humble little schoolhouse in Kells, God sent out a stream of light and of fire that touched the whole country. Roman Catholics were saved. The priests used to go around sprinkling holy water in Roman Catholic homes, trying to drive back the demons of revival, and they couldn't do it. Roman Catholics were saved. Drunkards were saved. Children, this is the amazing thing. Children were saved. And as soon as they were saved, they could pray and they could discourse with the erudition of a theologian. Where did they learn it? Well, they had learned their catechisms. But they had learned from God. Those were tremendous days. Days when mill girls would rush out from the factory in Belfast to Fisherwick Presbyterian Church, crowding into that great sanctuary just to hear the gospel. People who had been outside the church. People, working people. People who felt the church was not for them, suddenly were drawn with magnetic power to hear the gospel. My, what works of God were done. If you come from Belfast, as Joan and I do, you would know a place called the Botanic Gardens. That's Belfast's only approximation to the luxuriant beauty of the tropics. There under the great glass dome, you can go in and you can see flora and fauna from various parts of the world. Many a time as kids we would go to the Botanic Gardens and just walk around. But in 1859, those gardens were filled with tens of thousands of people. They came to hear a young fellow called Spurgeon. They came to hear another by the name of H. Grattan Guinness, one of the greatest preachers England has ever produced. They came to hear the gospel. This was a year of revival. Spurgeon went back to his own tabernacle, knowing full well that many, even evangelicals, were questioning, is this of God? Can it be of God when the decorum of the church is being breached? Can it be of God when people are screaming in their awful agony of soul? Can it be of God when people are smitten to the ground and fall unconscious under conviction? Can it really be of God? Oh, how we want to tie God up in our own little box. How we want to dictate to God, work, but work my way. I want to tell you, my friend, when God works, he works his way, and you'd better like it or get offside. Spurgeon defended what God was doing, prayed that he would do it in England, and so he did. God moved throughout the United Kingdom, and to this very day, certainly in Northern Ireland, I can bring you to great churches that were built just to house the converts. Look at a map of the world. Northern Ireland is so small on it, you can hardly find it. And yet, in 1 year, 100,000 people passed from death unto life by the mighty power of God. Evangelicalism was on the march. And while the whole century was not a century of revival, nonetheless, that mighty movement of revival sums up much of what God was doing in the century. He had marshaled a great evangelical army. I've only mentioned some parts of it. The Salvation Army was born in this century, in the slums of London, and then spread across the world to reach out to the poor and the needy, to preach Christ to them, and then, of course, to seek to meet them at the point of physical need as well. God marshaled a great evangelical army and set it marching across the world. And where it marched, whether it was in England or in other countries in Europe or in North America, or whether it was in India or in darkest Africa or wherever it marched, it brought blessing in its train. But evangelicalism was not the only force on the march. There was another force that burst upon the scene, and that is what I term evolutionism. It was not new, for there have been theories of evolution since ever men were fit by sin to question God and His creation. The ancient Greeks had their theories of evolution. But it wasn't until 1859 that it gained a new impetus from the production of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species. Interesting, is it not, that in the very year of revival, you had the production of this book that more than any other single work written either until that time or since that time has turned the hearts and minds of men against God, against Christ, against the Bible, and against truth. The amazing thing is that it has done this with about 99% of all people in the English-speaking world never having even seen the book, never mind read it. Darwin's Origin of Species propounded the theory of evolution. The theory that nature is self-contained, that nature is self-sufficient, that all living things are the undesigned products of random variations and natural selection, which is a scientific way of describing the survival of the fittest. This includes men. Men, according to Darwin, as he went on to write his Descent of Man, men are supposedly descended by chance mutations. Well, that's the modern Darwinian way of putting it. Actually, Darwin didn't believe in mutations. He believed in slight variations. And he has a chapter in his book with a Latin heading, which means nature does not leap. Nature doesn't go forward by mutations. But forget about that. I mean, it doesn't really matter whether Darwinians today believe Darwin or not. It really doesn't matter. But ultimately, it came to be the view that men have descended by mutations from apes, that by a whole host of mutations came ultimately from some biotic soup. In those days they called it a primeval slime. There was something very interesting about slime. They thought that somehow or other slime could produce all that was necessary to life and the higher organizations in various forms of life. But this, we are now told, this biotic soup, this primeval slime, came into existence with everything else in the universe as the result of a big bang about 18 billion years ago. Now, if anybody told you today that everything that is in all the solar systems, in all the organisms of all the universe, that it all came about from the Big Bang exploding from a microscopic dot smaller than a pinhead. That all the energy necessary for everything that is concentrated to a dot smaller than a pinhead that decided, well, didn't decide, for no reason, to burst out to produce everything that is. If anybody told you that happened 100 years ago, you'd said, we have a place for people like you. But put it back enough billions of years, and you see, lunacy suddenly becomes science. Darwinism proved very popular. It was soon used to explain everything in every area of science. Biological science, geological science. Actually, Darwin had started reading Charles Lyell's views of geology and what's called uniformitarianism. The present is the key to the past, and present processes at present rates are sufficient to describe and define and explain all that you see in the rock formations of the world. So, geological science, every other branch of science, even political science, became to be defined by Darwinism, and even theology, believe it or not. Karl Marx used Darwinism to validate his view of history and his communist dreams. The German anarchist Friedrich Nietzsche, he said God is dead. Normally we think of the God is dead theology from the 1960s, but this is back in those, the previous century. He said that God is dead, and with him, and by the way, interesting, when they say God is dead, they're not talking about Buddha. And they're not talking about Allah. They're always talking about the God of Christianity. I don't find scientists going out of their way to disprove Islam. Why? Because they know the truth they're fighting. God is dead. The God of Christianity, he said, is dead, so that belief in him is beyond belief. And with his death, there is the death of all Christian virtue. Because Christian virtues are only ways of pandering to the weak and to the ailing. His was a theory that if he did not actually put it into practice, nonetheless formed the foundation for the Hitlerite notion of the extermination of the weak. And after all, if you believe in Darwinism, why shouldn't you? If man is intrinsically no more valuable than a frog, and a frog is no more valuable than a blade of grass, or a mustard seed, or even a rock on the ground. If man is no more valuable, and if we've got to where we are by the survival of the fittest, then why shouldn't the fittest now survive and the weak and the ailing be exterminated? That's how the Nazis read Nietzsche, and the world suffered the Holocaust and all that went with it as a result. The higher critics used Darwinism to attack the Bible. I haven't time to go into their theories. They actually tried to make God the product of evolution. God is actually the product of the evolving religious consciousness of man. The Bible is not what it pretends to be. The first five or six books. They started with five, then some wanted to include the book of Joshua. Some actually have wanted to go even further than that. Where a patchwork of documents, they produced what they called the J-E-D-P theory. J standing for the Jehovah's writer, E for the Elohist writer, D for the Deuteronomic writer, and P for the priestly writer. And from this patchwork of documents, a skillful editor, possibly Ezra, put together the Old Testament as we now have it. That J-E-D-P theory took possession of seminaries in Germany and soon in Britain. Thankfully in America it had a harder time, though it came to conquer here as well. But America did have some great theologians in the last century who stood up to this onslaught of German rationalism. Archibald Alexander for one, Charles Hodge for another, William Shedd for another, Robert Dabney, Henry Thornwell, later Alexander Hodge, B.B. Warfield. You could go on down the line, and then a host of excellent biblical scholars and exegetes. America, for many years, was actually the only stronghold of theological opposition to this rationalistic Darwinianism brought into theology. But you know, at the end of the day, what stood to conquer evolutionism was not the brilliance of theological argument, though that was very important, very important. And I think it says something that to this day, if you're studying theology, you cannot study better than Shedd or Hodge or Dabney or Thornwell. You cannot study better than those. We have had many come and go from then, but those were men who stood in the gap in the time when they were needed. England had some. Scotland had some. Certainly I have mentioned the great Scottish preachers. But it was the Americans most of all who held the pass. But at the end of the day, however important, what really stood in the way of evolutionism was the work of the eminent evangelists and the missionaries who turned the hearts of men to God. You see, we always come back to this. Evangelicalism cannot prosper merely in the rarefied atmosphere of academia. Evangelicalism cannot win its battles merely by going to the state house or the courthouse. Let me emphasize this. I'm all in favor of using both state house and courthouse to force the evolutionists and the humanists onto a level playing field. But let me remind you of this. We as evangelicals must not fall into the trap that the liberals once fell into. It used to be the liberals who were saying, if we can only get enough people in politics, if we can only get enough decent judges on the bench, we will change society. That's what the liberals thought. And they were wrong. Evangelicals have always believed that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation, and let us see God move to the saving of souls on such a scale as it changes the country. That's not to say you're not involved in other endeavors. Far from it. But it is to say that though we may hold the pass by apologetics, by theological argument, by people placed in positions of political eminence, the only thing that changes the hearts and minds of men is the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's what evangelicalism found. And as long as evangelicalism had the power of revival, evolutionism made little progress. Oh, it gained its converts among the Thomas Huxleys of this world. But it did not sweep the mainstream of either Britain or America until evangelicalism ran out of revival power. What we need today is a return to that power. Wherever the evangelicals went, they produced blessings under God to men's souls and men's bodies. Thousands and tens of thousands were saved. They relieved suffering. They cared for the orphans. They reformed labor laws. They reformed prison laws. They built prosperous nations. They educated the ignorant. They rolled back the night of heathenism throughout the world. When they ran out of spiritual power, evolutionism corrupted morality, devalued life, usurped the educational process, and chained the world to a sterile scientific materialism. It's a fascinating theory. Personally, I think it's much more than a theory. That the modern problem, the Western world, of drugs and violent crime are the direct result of the spread of evolutionism and the replacement of evangelicalism. I know that drugs long preceded evolutionism, but just think of it this way. When evangelicalism was marginalized, to use the modern jargon, set aside, and evolution was taught from grade school through university, the element without which no man can adequately live, the element of the transcendent, was removed. And it had to be replaced somehow. Earlier this century, and I know I'm dealing with the 19th century, but to get the fruits of this, we come into this century. The philosopher and evolutionist Aldous Huxley recognized that he needed something to lift him to the realm of the mysterious and the religious. As an evolutionist, the only way he could get it was with psychotics and drugs and psychedelic drugs, things that were going to alter his state of consciousness. And he set forth on a crusade in England and America. We are living with the fruits of that crusade today. He started it in the 1930s to introduce young people to the religion of the drug culture, when they would be lifted to realms of ecstasy that had been taken away by the denial of God. The battle was on. It was not confined to the 19th century. It's being fought again today. George Bernard Shaw parodied Genesis chapter 1, where God made man in his own image, and he spouted the evolutionist line that man made God in his image. That's what evolutionism did. We were reading tonight in Romans chapter 1 because it's the same battle. I haven't time to develop the thoughts of Paul and tie in what I've been saying about Darwin and Darwinism. But let me say it's the same battle. Paul speaks of three great revelations, the righteousness of God revealed, and that's the particular glory of the gospel. That's what evangelicalism's message is all about. That's the message that brought revival. I was interested to read in one of the letters at the back of Sprague's Lectures on Revival of the doctrines that God particularly blessed in bringing in revival. And they were the doctrines that were central to the old Calvinistic exposition of the gospel. The righteousness of God revealed. In verse 18 through to 21, the rebellion of man is revealed. And that is the story that we have been recounting of evolutionary opposition to the gospel. Ungodly, unrighteous, suppressors of the truth, deniers of the witness of creation, with vain minds and darkened imaginations, ending up denying God in His sovereignty and worshipping the creature more than the Creator. It's the rebellion of man. Ah, but listen, this is the most telling part of all. The wrath of God is revealed. The God who revealed righteousness for salvation reveals wrath unto damnation for those who deny His gospel. He gives them up. Verse 24. You're not, this is Romans 1 we're reading, not USA Today for tomorrow's date. He gives them up to what? Verse 24, pornography. What is the slime in which America is drowning and Britain is drowning tonight? It is the slime of pornography. Woe to a people when God gives them up to uncleanness. Then in verse 26, He gives them up to perversion, sodomy, lesbianism. Do you see what God is saying? These are not new things. But what held them in check was not legislation, was not strong men in politics or in the presidential office. It was the power of the gospel that held them in check. God says, when He removes that restraint, He gives them over, gives them up. God help a nation when it is given up to pornography and to perversion. And then worst of all, in verse 28, to a reprobate mind. To a mind that cannot judge soundly. To a mind that is so perverted that it uses all the powers of its intellect, all the gathered learning of its years, to substantiate the evil. It cannot see the wickedness of sin. It cannot see the goodness of grace. A mind devoid of sound judgment. God gives them up to a reprobate mind. You're living to see that. You're living to see that. Who among you could ever have believed 20 short years ago that you would be having states governments here in the United States taking steps to ensure that sodomite marriage stands on the same ground and the same level of acceptance as heterosexual marriage? Well, that's an oxymoron. There is no other kind of marriage. We're living in a day when black is white, and white is dirty gray, when the lines are blurred and people can't think straight, given up to a reprobate mind. The only answer to the curse of the rationalism and the irrationalism of evolutionism in the nation and in the church is a true evangelical revival. The preaching of the gospel which is the power of God unto salvation. Evangelicalism and evolutionism were on the march in the 19th century. For most of that century, evangelicalism was not only on the march, but was on the road to victory. It did great things. Do not let any half-blinded historian talk you out of the greatness of God's works in the last century. I know that it's easy for people nowadays to mock Victorian prudery and Victorian hypocrisy. No doubt there was a lot of that. But evangelicalism swept the world for God. In this century, the roles have been reversed. And it's evolutionism that has conquered far and wide. The battle is joined. We need evangelical fervor, to evangelical fire, and to evangelical success. Can God yet again bless the gospel? Is it still the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth? Then let us take God at his word, and let us not divert our attention and distract our energies from that which God has promised to bless, the preaching of the gospel. Let us storm the battlements of evolutionism and every other ism that is against God and his Christ. And let us look to our God once again to bless his word with revival and with power.